Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. Close fit. This case is really about two words, close fit. The question is whether under exacting scrutiny, or indeed under any First Amendment heightened scrutiny, whether the state has an adequate disclosure and reporting interest in reports from a dormant ballot initiative PAC. The PAC here in the record has had no speech for 10 years. It has had no money in the form of contributions. It has no money out in the form of expenditures. It has also not had a bank account for 5 years. The circuit court, in ruling on the constitutional claims, held that the PAC was capable of potential speech, and therefore, if the PAC wanted to remain dormant but in existence and therefore do nothing, the PAC bears the burden of reporting. The question for the court then is not what are the duties of an active PAC, but what are the duties of an inactive, dormant PAC that is capable of speech, that admittedly, concededly, whose primary purpose is political speech.
Does the law make a distinction between an active PAC and an inactive PAC?
The First Amendment does, Your Honor, absolutely. Both the Supreme Court and the Eighth Circuit have distinguished between entities that are engaged in speech, and that means bringing in money or expending money, and entities that are not engaged in speech. And that is because to hold otherwise would turn the First Amendment on its head in some ways. Because the burden here is on the state to prove up its interest under exacting scrutiny.
But doesn't the law provide a mechanism for identifying when a PAC is active or inactive? That's by filing a termination statement that you're not going to be active anymore, and then you have no more obligations. And this PAC chose not to do that. So you're saying there's some subjective indefinite time in there where there should be a stop. Does the First Amendment say after a year, after 5 years, after 6 years? Or what is unreasonable about saying on the point where you decide to file the termination letter?
Well, let me break that down, if I may, Judge.
Sure.
The first point is I think the PAC does not have to bear the burden of dissolving itself, that is, dissolving its ability, or rather the ability of this group of people to speak on an issue altogether, and therefore burden them in terms of their speech, their associational right to have to then go back and create a new PAC.
So you want the opportunity to remain active, but you don't want to bear the burden of filing the reports you have to do. You have to file when you're active.
Yes, absolutely, in the sense that the burden is on the state to prove up at any time what its reporting interest is. I think that hinges not on whether the PAC is in existence or not as a matter of law. It hinges on what activities the PAC is engaged in. And that goes to several issues in terms of the state's interests. First is quid pro quo corruption. That just does not apply here, because we are dealing with an issue PAC, not a PAC engaged in express advocacy for or against a candidate. The second is the sources of campaign spending. Again, that does not apply here where there is no money and no actual spending. The third is the broader interest in gathering information to generally enforce campaign statutes. Again, I submit when you have no spending, the state has no inherent interest in paperwork per se. The state, under the First Amendment, the state has no inherent interest in receiving reports on inactivity, because the state's burden under MCFL, under McIntyre, under some of the other federal case law, is to show that their interests are vitally important, that they are paramount, and the burden is on the government to show that there is a close fit, that there is not a less burdensome way of achieving the state's interests. And I submit that a less burdensome way is to require reporting if and when there is actual activity.
But how would the state know that there's no activity? How if you don't submit bank statements or you don't submit some type of statement saying that we've gone inactive, how would the state know otherwise? And is that really overly burdensome on PACs to do?
Yes. Let me take your second point first, Your Honor. These are not tax forms, and I think the Eighth Circuit made that point well in Swanson. We know that entities, for example, bear the burden of going out and hiring lawyers or accountants to fill out tax forms. But here we're dealing with political speech. This is the most protected form of speech under the First Amendment. And speech such as that the PAC engages in contributes to the marketplace of ideas.
But is reporting actually political speech? The reporting forms, are those political? Is that considered political speech?
It is a burden on political speech. I agree that it is not this level of scrutiny is exacting scrutiny because we're looking not at a content-based restriction. We are looking at merely disclosing money in, money out. But still exacting scrutiny, Judge Russell, is not a light standard. It is not a deferential standard to the legislature. Courts have made this clear time and time again that that the state's interest has to be tethered to actual money. And that's not a new idea.
But how do we know if there's money if you don't file a report saying there's not?
Well, I think the burden is on the PAC, or the entity, to make that affirmative report if there is money.
But the state has no interest in requiring reports to be filed periodically so that it is ensured that the PAC does so, or elsewhere, if the PAC files fraudulently, of course, then that would be subject to sanctions.
It does not, Your Honor, and the reason is in the real world, people run out of steam. People gather together to speak on issues of political importance. People associate on issues of political importance. In this case, it was a group.
The Citizens United addressed this in some way with respect to the anonymity of donors to PACs.
That is not the issue that we have really presented here, Your Honor, in terms of the record here, but certain Citizens United and some of the other related case law do question in the context of ballot initiative advocacy, in terms of issue advocacy, if the state really has an interest in the identity of the donors. But that's really not the point we're raising here. Certainly McIntyre stands for the proposition that a school tax levy where someone distributed anonymous flyers opposing the school tax, that the state simply had no interest in disclosing the speaker's identity. But that's not the issue presented by the record here. Again, that would go to a record where there is actual activity or the duties of an active PAC. I would also say that I concede that PACs are burdensome to administer. Citizens United holds as much, and it remarks that perhaps that's why there are so few of them, at least under federal law. But I would distinguish PACs at Missouri law in three ways. One is that the Missouri definition of a committee is pretty broad. If two or more people want to associate together and spend more than $500, at least when they are actively speaking, that's a committee. And that then triggers ongoing and indefinite reporting requirements. And that is slightly different than the case law that discusses candidate-related committees or express advocacy committees. The second one is that even if PACs are more burdensome to administer, again, the state's interest relates only to that money coming in and out. And although Citizens United does call that burden onerous, if we go back and look at some of the older cases, to the extent they're not overruled, Justice Stevens and McConnell, for example, discusses Buckley. But again, Buckley was tethered to actual spending, in that case at least $100 on express advocacy. In McConnell, they're looking at triggers of $1,000 for an association, a union or a corporation, or $10,000 for individuals. But what Swanson and also from the Tenth Circuit, Sampson, say is that the state has to prove up that burden, and the burden has to be tethered to actual money. The other thing I want to discuss is chilling. Here there was an actual enforcement action against each of the PAC and Mr. Geyer. And that affects Mr. Geyer because the record clearly shows that he's a private citizen who cares about his reputation, but he also has
Mr. Geyer fill these forms out himself during all the years that they were filled out?
I concede he did not, Your Honor. I concede that the record reflects that for about 10, for most of the period at which the inactivity reports were filled out, someone else filled out those forms and submitted that technical requirement. And Nevertheless, the enforcement action was not only against the PAC, it was also against Mr. Geyer personally. And so that did cause Mr. Geyer fear.
But it wasn't. They found, they said, in his capacity as treasurer in the order, it addressed that. Didn't address any personal, suggest that he did anything personally wrong.
I don't know if it's that clear, Judge Diff.
Well, doesn't it say in his capacity as treasurer in the order itself?
No, in the circuit court or in the commission?
You would have them before you there.
Right.
I can certainly find them for you, but why don't you tell me?
Does the record indicate what cost was incurred after there were no funds in the PAC?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Does the record indicate what, if any, financial costs were incurred after the PAC had no funds to pay and they continued to report?
What costs were incurred by the PAC or by Mr. Geyer or either?
Either one.
Well, certainly, I would say the in terms of a financial cost, the record does not reflect that. I think that the court can read, though, there is a burden on the PAC itself to have to fill out a quarterly report. I mean, I think that is just a matter of common sense.
Well, you're talking about this big burden, but if they continued with no money to be able to fill out the reports and comply, all but for a short time, that doesn't seem like it was much of a financial burden on the PAC to do so.
The burden here, Judge Fischer, really comes from the enforcement action itself as a secondary burden, and that's when the burden, I would suggest, sharply increases. At that point, Mr. Geyer personally is incurring legal fees.
Right, but I guess my point is if they can avoid the burden of a penalty at no cost by compliance.
Well, I would disagree that there is no cost, Judge Fischer.
But what cost is indicated in the record?
The cost is that it the cost is not is that, well, number one, that the PAC at some point ran out of steam and so stopped filing these reports, and therefore as a matter of common sense we can infer that when people don't want to speak actively, when they don't want to associate actively, that there is a cost, because if it was cost free, why else would they not have filed these reports, in a sense?
What's the evidence in the record as to why they didn't file the termination statement?
Well, the evidence is mostly comes from Mr. Two things, Chief Justice. One is that the committee ran out of steam. So in that sense, there just simply was a group of people that at that moment didn't want to speak and therefore didn't want to bear the ancillary burdens of reporting on their inactivity. But the second burden is that Mr. Geyer's testimony at the MEC hearing, and that is part of the record here, was that he tried to terminate initially. He was not allowed to terminate because MEC initially at least told him that the treasurer was responsible for dealing with the debts of the committee. There was also this issue that MEC wanted him to produce old bank statements. He did not have those in his possession.
What was that, after the enforcement proceeding had begun?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so was there evidence as to why, prior to failing to file these, there was the termination statement is or the termination document is how many pages?
I believe the record reflects the termination. It is a one-page document.
One page. Okay. And was there any evidence prior to failing to file the required reports, was there any testimony as to why it was not filed at that time?
I believe not, Your Honor, but I think the separate question is, did the PAC want to terminate? Did the PAC intend to terminate, or did they intend rather?
But you want, you're saying they didn't want to terminate because they wanted the option of undertaking activity, but they should be treated as inactive. And I don't understand why you get both. There's a provision, if you want to be inactive, you can terminate. If you don't want to terminate, why is the burden too high simply to file inactivity reports? Because at any moment, you could become active. That's why you didn't terminate. So the state needs to know.
Well, I do think the record reflects that the PAC did, in fact, terminate because it didn't want to bear the burden of filing these quarterly reports. I see in the sense where you're going, Judge Stith was saying, well, these don't seem that burdensome. Every 3 months you need to file out a form.
Well, it's just if the reason you didn't want to terminate is you wanted the option to become active again, then why isn't that enough for the state to say, then you need to file reports, because we don't know if you've chosen to reactivate your activities unless you file a report informing us of that.
I think that misconstrues the state's burden as in having reporting paperwork and having having information. And the state's interest is not in having paperwork or information per se. The state's interest is in having information on actual money coming in or out. The state has no inherent interest under exacting scrutiny in having just a form filed every 3 months. That seems more analogous to a tax situation or something where one has a statutory duty that is not offset by the First Amendment scrutiny.
And why is this different than that?
Because the First Amendment does not allow undue government burdens on the marketplace of ideas. And so for an association of people, and I think this is the only way.
Does your PAC have to file federal tax returns yearly?
That's not part of the record here. So, in all candor, I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't believe that it's a taxable entity.
Now, you're looking for relief in this case, where there's no money and no. But you're also asking us to declare the statute unconstitutional, which would apply to, let's say, a PAC for right to work or a PAC for something else. Is that correct?
Well, I think the scope of the remedy is something that Citizens United addresses well. And the facial versus as-applied challenge, which is what I think you're getting at, Judge Tittleman, is actually less important. The question is, here the as-applied record is of an inactive PAC. And certainly the questions that appellants are raising here have to do with inactivity. But to the extent that this court would choose to enjoin enforcement of those statutes against an inactive PAC, I don't see how it can do it without declaring the statute itself to be facially overbroad. Because if you enjoin enforcement as to this PAC, then how can you not enjoin enforcement as to other PACs?
Your time is up. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is the clock not working?
Oh, is it not?
It doesn't show, and I didn't see any lights. That's why.
See lights now?
I do not.
Interesting.
Ours is working.
Only one.
No. We'll let you know.
We'll take it.
That's fine. Whatever we need to do, I just need to know.
Well, we gave your opposing counsel about 5 extra minutes.
Now it says
so
15.
That explains why.
Interesting.
No, that was okay.
No, you were answering questions. That's appropriate.
May it please the court, let me stop briefly at point 4 and point 2 from the appellant's brief and then go to what they actually discussed this morning. Point 4 deals with some questions about vagueness and personal liability and the like. And I just want to make one observation, and that is that much of point 4 is based on a reading of 105.963. That statute does not implicate it in this case. It deals with late fees and fines and things that never came up here. This case is solely under 105.961 rather than 963. Second is to the question about the open hearing claim in point 2. I just make this observation that the Administrative Hearing Commission treats these cases when they arrive there as it does other cases, and it holds open hearings. Now, there wasn't an open hearing here because there were no disputed facts, and so it was decided under summary determination, a form of summary judgment. But there was had it gone to a hearing, that hearing would have been open at the AHC, just as hearings at the AHC are normally open. The statute that's invoked only relates to the actions of the commission when the commission is acting in a certain respect a little like a grand jury. It's actually determining whether there's probable cause to proceed. So let me turn then to the First Amendment questions. This, of course, is not a direct speech claim. Mr. Geyer doesn't claim there's any direct limitation on his ability to speak, nor does Stop Now claim there's any direct limitation on its ability to speak. It's an indirect case, and it deals only with the Missouri statute that addresses disclosure. And disclosure statutes are not subject to strict scrutiny. They're subject to something called exacting scrutiny. The Eighth Circuit didn't use the words close fit when it recently addressed that standard. It said exacting scrutiny requires substantial relation, that's not close fit, between the disclosure requirement and a sufficiently important governmental interest, and cites the U.S. Supreme Court decision.
In which Doe. Case of that was the Eighth Circuit?
That's in the Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life case. And then says to withstand, in citing from the Doe case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, a 2010 case, the court says to withstand this scrutiny, the strength of the government's interest must reflect the seriousness of the actual burden on First Amendment rights. It really is a balancing test. That's also evident in Timmons. There's a lengthy quotation from Timmons in the Galassini case that appellants put in their appendix, where the U.S. Supreme Court says First and 14th Amendment associational rights, well, when deciding whether a state election law violates First and 14th Amendment associational rights, we weigh the character and magnitude of the burden of the state's rule on those rights against the interests of the state in justifying that burden.
Opposing counsel says the state really has no interest in getting reports of inactivity.
This is a unique case because it is so remote from the speech because of the years that have passed. And frankly, I think what the appellants are asking for is the court say that if somebody can stiff the state long enough, the state loses its ability to do anything about it. Interesting proposition. But if you look at the state's size, the state still has an interest in disclosure. And the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly indicated that disclosure is a legitimate state interest. Judge Malloy, now dissenting in the Minnesota Citizens for Life case, said that one of the two fundamental principles is that the voting public has a right to know where the money is coming from. In the Sampson case out of the Tenth Circuit, the appellants rely on, the court said that in Buckley v. Valeo, the court recognized an informational interest, and that on three occasions since, the court has spoken favorably of disclosure requirements in the context of ballot issues and has never rejected those. In the Wisconsin Right for Life decision out of the Seventh Circuit, again, they rely on, the court said the public's informational interest in knowing the sponsorship and funding sources of election-related ads had long been accepted as sufficiently important to justify disclosure and disclaimer rules. The state's interest is not lost just because some years have passed. But let's go back to kind of what the state's interest is in the kind of documents that we're talking about here. Missouri has a system that requires that each of these PACs, and that's all we're talking about here is PACs, each of these PACs have a particular bank account in Missouri and a treasurer who is responsible for tracking what goes in and out of that bank account. Well, what we have here is an entity that no longer has a bank account. And so when the commission started this process, they discovered that there's no bank account anymore, and there's no way for them to audit what it is that this PAC is doing because there's no bank account to look at.
Mr. Layton, you mentioned a balancing test.
Yes.
Is the balancing in the hands of the commission or the court?
Well, the balancing is in the hands of the court. The legislature has said what it is that the commission must do, and then the court has to do the balancing to see if that burden outweighs the state's interest. The state has an interest in ensuring disclosure of where money that is contributed goes, or in this instance, where it went, and where what it purchased went, that is, where any assets that were purchased ended up, and where what happened with debt. Here there was $4,500 worth of debt that until the termination statement, there was no indication what had happened to that. And in the termination statement, although it doesn't quite say this, it appears that the debt has simply been written off by the lenders. But the state has a continuing interest in ensuring that we, and in fact even that the people who contribute to these committees, can see where the money goes. And the problem here became when the state could no longer see where the money went.
Now, getting back to what you're saying about the donors.
Yes.
Is it conceivable that the freedom of speech is really about the donors not wanting people to know who they're contributing money to?
Well, there are...
And if they choose to give to someone who throws the money away, that's their choice, but...
There are cases like that. There has been litigation on cases like that, but this case doesn't address that. There's no objection here to the identity of the donors being known, the identity of the lenders being known, the identity of the recipient of any property.
In fact, there's no objection to filing reports when money is being given. The
right.
Only objection is when it's not being given, so
yes.
There is nothing to report.
And that's not really even a report. Although we call it that, it's really just a statement. Judge Bonestock described it as a single-page form requiring StopNow to list background information, that is, you know, kind of what's your address still, and then check a box indicating which time period corresponds to the statement. It is a statement that nothing's been going on. It really isn't a report.
Is that sworn in any way or
I don't believe it's sworn, although it does go over the name of the treasurer. That is, the treasurer is by statute responsible for filing reports and for filing this statement if there are no reports that need to be filed. And the state has a continuing interest in ensuring that treasurers do their job. That is, we've created a structure in which we have a point person for every one of these committees. Someone who is statutorily required to know what's going on and to tell us when something happens that matters. That's the treasurer. Treasurer can delegate to a deputy if there's one known, and the treasurer can have somebody else do the work. But ultimately, the treasurer's name goes on the document, and the treasurer is responsible for reviewing
the document.
So if the treasurer is responsible, does the statute indicate, is the treasurer responsible in his personal capacity or in his official capacity?
It doesn't. This statute, 961, doesn't indicate that.
Well, if the treasurer no longer wants to be the treasurer, they can just resign. I mean, we've had that happen, right?
The treasurer could resign. Someone would have to then be designated to be the treasurer. That is, our system doesn't contemplate you can have a committee without a treasurer, just like it doesn't contemplate you can have a committee without a particular bank account, because we have no way of tracking the funds and seeing what's going on without a name and a bank account.
And I found what I was looking for in the record earlier. The MEC ended up only sending a letter and not and the letter states that Geyer violated provisions of the campaign finance laws in his capacity as treasurer.
That's what it says.
There was nothing that found a violation in a personal capacity. Is that right?
No, only as treasurer. And there is no dispute here that that is true. So you can look at the original pleading in the AHC, you can look at the pleading in the circuit court, you can read the brief in this court, and there is no dispute that that is true.
But actually the Ethics Commission found there was probable cause that he had violated, not that he'd actually done it.
Yes.
And then they further said it was not done knowingly.
Knowingly.
And there were no sanctions.
There was no
referrals.
Yes.
I'm trying to see what the harm was or how he was aggrieved.
Well, I mean, he's suggesting there's some kind of chilling, and I don't know what that is. Because he is still free to himself speak in politics, to himself organize another committee. He's even free to be treasurer again of another committee if he wants to do that. So I don't know where this chilling is. There's a suggestion in the brief that he's afraid that in his professional life there could be some impact because there is this decision, there's probable cause to believe the undisputed fact that he as treasurer didn't fulfill his statutory duty. But that's out there regardless. I mean, if his clients see that he didn't do what the statute requires, then I don't know that the fact that if he can persuade you that the statute couldn't legitimately require that is going to help him very much.
You're saying it's not the MEC letter, but the facts that arguably
right.
would affect any
future
services.
It is the facts. It's not the letter. It's the facts that actually are harmful, if they are harmful, and I just don't know that they are harmful.
Although if he was to want to become a member of the bar, he'd have to report this to the bar.
No.
Or if he wanted to do something else,
an official,
he'd have to report this to someone.
I don't believe so, because there's no sanction here. It's an unknowing violation. I don't know enough about the Board of Accountancy, but in the cases I have dealt with the Board of Accountancy, it would have to be a criminal violation for there to be an obligation to report. And the conclusion here, very early in this investigation, was that there's no criminal violation. It simply was an omission. And understand kind of what happened here is that these reports kept coming in. I still don't know who sent them in, because even in the brief, quite candidly, appellants say it wasn't him, but we don't know who did it. And so when they quit coming in, then someone at the commission has a tickler of some kind that says, oh, we haven't gotten this one. And so at that point, they tried to figure it out. The Administrative Hearing Commission found that when they sent notices to Guyer, he didn't respond. Guyer says that at some point he did respond, and in his petition he says, but his response was that he lacked sufficient information as to the interim activity and as to the bank account. That is, as treasurer, he didn't know about the bank account or what had happened with the bank account. That's a very troubling admission at the beginning of their petition. And it just shows the state has a continuing interest in knowing what happens with these committees.
You're almost out of time, and I wanted to address the ripeness argument. You state that this is not ripe, but your opponent says in the First Amendment context, ripeness arguments are relaxed.
Well, they are relaxed, but you still have to have some kind of a claim that you are going to do something that is being inhibited. It's not entirely clear what kind of claim you have to make for chilling a First Amendment claim, but in our view, it has to be something more than what we have here, which is this hypothetical that maybe someday someone involved with this PAC might want to do something, and in some kind of unfathomable way, the fact that they belatedly filed this termination statement is going to inhibit that. I don't understand that argument. I think that that it may not be right, hence that is in our brief. But the point ultimately is that what we have here is a system in which every committee, at some point, if they're not going to keep going, they have to account to the people of this state for what happened, so that it's closed, we know what happened, we're done. In this instance, that didn't happen until after the commission found that reports hadn't been filed. It's now been done. The commission found it had been done. Ultimately, it was done properly, and the case ought to be closed. Thank you.
Thank you.
What harm is done if the commission doesn't know what's going on? I mean, if no reports are filed, or is it a bureaucratic requirement, or does it have a substantive requirement?
Excuse me, just here. The timer hasn't started.
Oops.
Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Teitelman, the MAC obviously has broad enforcement capabilities. They routinely subpoena, investigate persons, committees, entities. The statute contemplates actually how a complaint may be filed. And
well, they don't enforce. They investigate. You're talking about investigation. And
yes.
They don't actually do any enforcement, right?
Well, that gets to the third issue, which I didn't really discuss.
I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish asking this question.
Discuss which I want to distinguish this case from IMPE. But the issue there, real quick, Judge Teitelman, is that the burden is on MEC, if they want to do an investigation, to do so, and they certainly have that ability under the statute. But the question separately in terms of this bureaucratic requirement is, does that properly fall in the PAC when there's no speech? Because the state's interest is in speech, is in money. It is not in a committee per se, or in a certain form per se. Even if it isn't prescribed by statute, that's just not what the First Amendment jurisprudence says. Turning to your point, Judge Stith, I think this case is distinguishable from IMPE in terms of the function and process of MEC. IMPE did not reach the constitutional claims there because the appellants did not properly and timely raise their constitutional claims and did not appeal to the AHC. Here, of course, we have a record where the constitutional claims were raised early on with MEC, which doesn't even have the ability to adjudicate them, and throughout the process. And so that's why. But the biggest irony here, and this goes to the open hearing in terms of the MEC hearing, because that was the only contested hearing where people actually put on evidence, is that the state's underlying interest here is information. And it's deeply ironic when the state's only interest is public information, public disclosure, that they close the hearing to the public, the one hearing where there actually are witnesses, where it is contested. Finally, I just want to turn to standing and ripeness. I want to get back to the two farmers in Swanson. Jerry Geyer testified at the MEC hearing that he no longer has any interest in serving as a PAC treasurer. He tells his other friends who are accountants, don't serve as a PAC treasurer. Don't bother. That is chilling. That is ripeness, because you are dissuading people from participating in the marketplace of ideas. We are burdening future participation in the marketplace of ideas. We don't need someone to say, next year I'm not going to do it.
Don't we only want, as treasurer, people who are willing to perform the obligations imposed on treasurers by statute? And was he discouraging people because he didn't believe that you can require accounting of bank accounts and of PAC monies?
Well,
And how is that speech as opposed to the membership of the organization or people giving money to the PAC is speech? But how is serving as treasurer and being dissuaded from serving as treasurer because you don't want to file appropriate bank statements of your bank account and so forth, how is that chilling?
Because it improperly opens the treasurer up to being a respondent in an enforcement action by MEC when the statute says that in terms of the enforcement teeth of Chapter 130, if we go back to Chapter 105,
So you're attacking any reporting requirements, whether active or inactive?
No, I'm attacking them only in the context of inactivity. I think there's a big distinguishment between a treasurer who's a member of a PAC that is active, who is both speaking into the marketplace of ideas and fulfilling his statutory duties, as opposed to someone who is not.
Do you disagree with Mr. Layton's characterization as the exacting scrutiny standard being a balancing test?
Absolutely. I think the Supreme Court, both with strict scrutiny and exacting scrutiny, has always rejected a balancing test analysis. Rather, the burden is solely on the state to prove up its interest. Admittedly, under exacting scrutiny, that is less than a content-based analysis, but nevertheless, the burden falls solely on the state to prove up that interest, and that interest is money.
Thank you. Your time is up. Case will be submitted.